Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with harpsichordist and Temple University music professor Joyce Lindorf. A celebration of early keyboard music she's helped organize culminates this evening with a concert at Temple University exploring music in 18th century Philadelphia. Susan Lewis looks at the Woodmere Art Museum in Philadelphia's 69th annual juried exhibition. Tom Keels explores the cooperation between historic sites in the Germantown section of Philadelphia and the local school districts that have made thousands of students into history hunters. And we listen again to Jason Pfeiffer's exploration of the rich history of the Fulton Opera House in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, the nation's oldest continuously operating theater. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Members of the Southeastern Historical Keyboard Society came together in Philadelphia this week for meetings, discussions, and of course performances. Founded in 1980, the Society is committed to the promotion of interest in and study of early keyboard instruments, principally the harpsichord, clavichord, fortepiano, and organ prior to 1860, and the music intended for these instruments. The culmination of the week's events comes this evening with a free concert at Temple University's Rock Hall, exploring music in Philadelphia in the 18th century. I spoke with the Southeastern Historical Keyboard Society's president, harpsichord and Temple University music professor Joyce Lindorf, earlier this week. So an evening of music from 18th century Philadelphia, not all of it created in Philadelphia, clearly.
Not all of it created in Philadelphia. I think we forget that Philadelphia was a very musical city, and there were so many concerts going on. In fact, the first concert series was held in the City Tavern. It was the City Concerts. And for a while, I was even thinking maybe we might have this concert in the City Tavern. And I went down and looked at it and spoke with the people there and with Independence Park. It was logistically just too hard because it's a restaurant now and they have their activities going on. But Independence Park really helped me out in the planning of this concert. Although it's up here, we actually think we may be going down to the park later on in the spring and doing this as a day concert for visitors to Philadelphia.
So tell us some of the connections. First on the program is Haydn. What's Haydn's connection to Philadelphia?
Well, remember in the beginning in this country's history, everyone was really busy and they were creating their own society. They were very occupied with things like signing the Declaration of Independence, and music was a big part of their lives. But many of the composers were considered amateurs. They were people who could do statesmanship, politics, gardening, music. They were really polymaths, like many settlers in foreign lands were. So you have someone like Francis Hopkinson, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, but you also have music that he wrote, songs and poems that he wrote. He was a real artist. And so even though he wasn't a professional, we really value and treasure all the music that he wrote. And this is the kind of thing that we would like to bring out on Saturday evening. Alexander Reinagel was, in fact, a professional musician, and he was very important in Philadelphia's early musical history, as was Reiner Taylor. And those are both on the program. Another important composer was Benjamin Carr, and I think people will just be amazed at some of the uniquely creative ideas that they had. Carr's piece is entitled The Siege of Tripoli, an historical naval sonata, and it's got narration, and it depicts this naval battle, and it should be really, really interesting, very unusual. The composer who isn't from Philadelphia is, of course, Haydn. When these people came over here, they brought the music of Europe with them. And these are pieces that were written exactly at the same time as the colonization and the signing was going on. So one of the sonatas that we'll hear on this concert will be the sonata in A major, number 45, which was written in 1776.
Can you put into context how people were listening to music, some of the music that we're going to hear in this concert this evening? How was that being heard in Philadelphia in its time?
Well, one way would have been very much like it would have been in England, and that is in church. And, of course, the evensong that we had last night was based on music that was written specifically for these kinds of services in Philadelphia in the 18th century for St. Peter's, in fact. And that was very important still in the New World. And of course, at that time, people were listening to music in a different way than we do now. Probably the rooms would have been smaller. It would have been a little less formalized, perhaps. Maybe they would have been eating and drinking at the same time that they were enjoying the music. And you can tell by some of the titles, they're kind of in fun, and they're not all that serious. Yes, we have some sonatas there, but we also have minuets and waltzes and songs on various subjects. So I think that it would have been more a part of home life, house music kind of idea.
The president of the Southeastern Historical Keyboard Society, harpsichordist and Temple University music professor Joyce Lindorf. The Boyer College of Music and Dance at Temple was the host and sponsor of the Society's annual conference this week. The final event of the week, a free concert at Temple's Rock Hall, takes place this evening at 7:30.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Juried art shows, where artists compete to be included and those accepted may vie for prizes, have a long tradition in art communities, the 18th and 19th century Paris salons being among the most notable. A Philadelphia area museum, which celebrates the artists of the region, has held such an event every year since its founding in 1940. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to the 69th annual juried show of the Woodmere Art Museum.
Imagine an open gallery space where several hundred paintings, drawings, photographs, and even sculptures congregate. Each work has already gone through one selection process, chosen by its creator for submission to a juried show. It's a decision that can be fraught with feeling, constrained by practical considerations, or made quickly as the deadline nears.
It's a really emotional process. I think if it touches me strongly, it's going to touch someone else.
I can't ship certain things. Sometimes it's too difficult.
I usually wait till the very last minute and try to make a gut choice.
Some artists might analytically research the jury and the institution and try to dispassionately make a match. But Thomas Delport finds it difficult to look at his work objectively.
I personally tend not to have any clue how people see my work. I am in love with the painting that I'm working on or the one that I just finished. Usually when I'm working on it, I'm frustrated and suffering terribly. But as soon as I think that it's good enough, I somehow switch to love. And so the two that I submitted were the ones that had been the most recent and were I was probably the most in love with at the time.
Objects of artwork everywhere waiting to be judged, accepted, or rejected used to be the selection scene at the annual juried show at the Woodmere Art Museum. Today, the selection of works is made on the basis of images submitted digitally. The jury, or in this case, the single juror, is selected by the museum, where Michael Schantz is director and CEO.
Well, what we try to do, actually, is to go outside of the area. Generally, the jurors do not know the artists and do not have favorites, as it were. And what you like to do is pick a juror who has sensibilities not only as a painter or a sculptor, but understands all media.
The museum essentially gives up curatorial control, says Schantz, adding that every juried show has a different feel to it, unique to the juror.
It really is the idiosyncrasies of the particular juror that are reflected ultimately in the selection.
It's not my criteria, it's their criteria that makes a show.
This show's juror is artist Sam Gilliam from Washington, D.C., whose 1995 Mixed Media on Paper appeared in the Woodmere's recent exhibition In Search of Missing Masters. He says the show depends on what comes in from the community, which he evaluates against what he knows both of the area and the larger world.
It's that what I see is what I get, literally. I find out what people are doing at that time. I find out what changes are being made compared to what artists are doing on the outside. And then I make that hard decision as to what is the most interesting.
Interesting in terms of color, composition, materials?
No, I mean, what is the most interesting in terms of tactics? Someone said color comes from a tube, you know. How I use it is what my tactics are.
While Schantz notes that nothing is shockingly avant-garde, no pickled pigs or the like, a range of tactics are in evidence in this exhibition of around 100 works in a variety of media, from figure drawing to watercolors to mixed media and sculpture. Laura Pritchard's bright yellow portrait Homage to Ramirez is batik on silk.
I paint with molten wax first, every place that's going to be white, and then dyes are painted over top of the wax, and the dye does not go into the silk where the wax is. And repeat that process once the dye is dry, put wax where I want to keep that color, and the process is repeated until the field is totally covered, and then the wax is taken out.
A colorful mixed-media quilt called Urban Voodoo by Tony Kersey had its beginnings in a dream.
I can't even explain how it came out. It just, one piece led into another piece that led into another piece. I knew that I wanted it to have a lot of contrast. I knew that I wanted it to have a lot of syncopated rhythms. Colors move through a piece in a certain way. If you had to liken it to a piece of jazz, it would be the drums and the horns, and you could hear the guitar or the bass all happening at the same time and moving across the page.
A 5-foot-long sculpture made from pieces of cherry wood, brass rods, and stones sits on the floor, a recent incarnation of the kind of sculpture that Diane Pepe began after a trip to Japan.
The wood and the rods were sort of the structure of these people, and the stones reflected their energy and their spirit. I realized that these newer pieces were really talking about the spirit of the human nature, that we have this energy and the spirit, and we have all this emotion, and yet we have an ordered structure that we sort of have within us that sort of contain this energy and order it and enable us to function within the world.
Each of these works has won a prize in its category, portrait, mixed media, and sculpture, respectively. But the whole system of admission and prizes can be mercurial.
2 years ago, I submitted and was accepted, and then last year I submitted and was not accepted, and then this year I was submitted and I was accepted and then won a prize.
Not just a prize. Painter Thomas Delport won top honors, the Woodmere Endowment Fund Memorial Prize, for his oil on linen, called Network of Conversations, a still life that seems anything but still. He says he focuses on color rather than objects because things reflect or absorb from their surroundings.
You know, if you were to put a white vase in a blue room, the vase you know mentally is white, that would be the said color, but the observed color would be what's being reflected on it.
And the paint itself seems to dance on the page.
Because I have a large amount of paint on the brush and how I push it onto the canvas, it tends to pull away and cause texture. So it adds another kind of dimension to it. It's the thickness of paint as well as the color that I want you to see.
Wanting to engage viewers is part of what drives artists to submit to shows such as this one, risking rejection but reinforcing a sense of community, both with other artists and the audience.
One of the things that I like to do is when I'm in a show someplace is kind of be a fly on the wall and stand near my piece and listen to what people have to say about it.
You know, people will come up and say, ooh, this reminds me or it looks like music. They see things that I necessarily are there consciously, but maybe they're subconsciously, and then you start to look at them in a different way.
It's just another way of sharing. And when I'm doing art, I'm always speaking about myself and my place in the world.
Juried shows are not universally accepted, says Michael Shantz. Some older successful artists don't bother to submit. Conversely, some museums are more object-oriented as opposed to serving the artists themselves. While the Woodmere has acquired a significant permanent collection of American art, Shantz thinks of it as an artist's museum with a history and a venue especially suited to carry on this tradition.
Artists were the founders. They were the first management of this institution. Artists have always been embedded in the activities. So for us, the juried show is symbolic, really, of a relationship with the artists that go way back.
And so the relationship also moves forward with the Woodmere's 69th annual juried exhibition, more than 100 works, 20 prizes, and an invitation to audiences to discover the creations of some of the region's brightest artists.
WRTI, Susan Lewis. The Woodmere Art Museum's 69th annual juried exhibition opens tomorrow and runs until June 7th. Is the study of American history an endangered species? A survey of 500 college students has found that 65% failed a basic American history test. While almost all of the participants could identify popular celebrities, less than a quarter knew James Madison as the father of the Constitution. Now WRTI's Tom Keels explores a local program that is bucking the trend and bringing the past to life for Philadelphia public school students.
Teachers who try to interest today's youngsters in American history must compete with the internet, instant messaging, and iPhones. Their biggest challenge may be elementary school students, who have been forced to focus on mathematics and reading by the No Child Left Behind Act. But on a recent afternoon at Clifton, the historic colonial mansion in Germantown, one class of fourth graders seems spellbound by the American Revolution.
Musketball. This would be shot out of a rifle. And you know what it does once it gets in your body? Did you ever see a pinball machine? It would go bump, 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 bump.
These students are participants in the History Hunters Youth Reporters Program, a joint venture of Germantown Historic Sites and the Philadelphia School District. Now in its sixth full year of operation, History Hunters has served more than 10,000 students in Mount Airy and Germantown. Stephen Haig, one of the developers of History Hunters, explains that the program grew out of the dual need to connect local students with history and to connect local historic sites with the reality of Germantown today.
And the question that we ask ourselves a lot is, how do these houses, which were primarily the homes of dead, rich, white, European males, how can they speak to everybody?
In 2001, four Germantown sites joined forces to develop a program which would teach students about their heritage in a lively, hands-on format. In Haig's eyes, these four locations represent nearly 200 years of American history.
Stenton, which is an early 18th century house that belonged to the secretary to William Penn, founder of the colony. Clifton, the site of the Battle of Germantown, major role in the American War for Independence. Wick, a historic house that documents Quaker life and farm life during the early 19th century. And the Johnson House, which is a place with a dazzling story about the Underground Railroad.
Working with consultants and the Philadelphia School District, employees of the four sites developed a year-long program for fourth and fifth graders who travel through American history by visiting each of the sites at roughly two-month intervals. Haig describes what students encounter at their first stop, Stenton, where James Logan negotiated treaties with Native Americans on the front lawn.
We have a role-playing activity where a class would be divided into groups where half acting as sort of colonial settlers, half acting as Native Americans, engaging in a role-playing exercise that deals with things like early cross-cultural contact, different language barriers, and how those can be addressed or overcome.
The second site students visit is Clifton, where the Battle of Germantown was fought in October 1777. On a cold winter day at the Clifton Barn, History Hunters guides await students from the C.W. Henry School in Mount Airy. Winky Hurwitz, a retired Philadelphia teacher who now acts as a guide, describes the equipment of a revolutionary soldier which the students will study that day.
Now, the table we're standing at right now has a uniform of a typical soldier, and we will have the kids touch, feel. Some of the kids will dress up with these things. We'll explain, like, what the helmet does, how it's supposed to make them look taller and fiercer. The shirt's their favorite. You put the shirt on a child and you explain to the child, this is your shirt, your PJs, and your underwear. And of course you get, ew.
A few minutes later, a school bus pulls up and 30 excited students pour out. They cluster around the tables, handling the different items, taking notes and trying not to shout out answers to the guide's questions.
Does anybody know from their History Hunter workbook what this is called?
Haversack,
good for you. And you know what? In your haversack, you would have had all kinds of things that you would have been carrying with you. One of the things would have been a cup.
Dennis Pickerel, the director of Stenton, explains why the students are taking so many notes.
There's a strong emphasis on literacy in the curriculum for these grade levels. So we decided to call it not just History Hunters, but the History Hunters Youth Reporter Program, with the idea that these students, they would be the reporters. And so we issued them little name tags that say press passes underneath them, and they had to take notes, and then they would go back to their classrooms, and they could write a newspaper story. Or if they wanted to be more creative, they could write a poem, they could do a drawing about it.
History Hunters cost roughly $60,000 a year to run and is funded by various foundation grants. In return, it provides the Philadelphia school system with a fully subsidized curriculum where everything, guides, site visits, workbooks, study materials, even the bus transportation, is covered by the program. For Pickerel, History Hunters offers many benefits to the participating sites as well.
the sites come alive with children, you know, and to hear them laughing and enjoying it and really getting it, you know, getting the history in a way that they might not in a traditional classroom learning environment.
Walk to the wall, see if you can find any holes yourself. Did you find any yet? Yeah.
Back at Clifton, the stories of the Battle of Germantown are a big hit with the C.W. Henry students, who search for the bullet holes that still mark the exterior of the mansion. One fourth grade student, Daniel Edwards, describes what he's gotten out of his visit.
We're learning about the soldiers in the war. They didn't have a lot of money because England has the money when they had to pay taxes and all that stuff.
How do you like this program so far?
It's really cool. I like it. I get to learn about the stuff that happened where I live.
Daniel's teacher, Carl Jackson, agrees that the History Hunters program gives his students a fresh outlook on their country's past.
They actually get to learn history in a better way. Instead of just sitting down reading the textbook, they're actually coming here with the activity book and the knowledge of the actual presenters, and they get the actual feedback that they need to progress and do better and understand more of Pennsylvania history.
The History Hunters Youth Reporters Program has won numerous state and national awards, including a $300,000 We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. This 3-to-1 challenge grant, which History Hunters is 75% of the way toward matching, will provide the program with a $1 million endowment. This will ensure that for many years to come, fresh crops of youth reporters will explore Germantown, hunting down the secrets of Philadelphia history.
WRTI's Tom Keels. This spring, the History Hunters will turn their attention to Wick to study home life in 19th century Germantown and to the Johnson House, where they'll learn about the Underground Railroad in Philadelphia. The Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia recently celebrated its 200th anniversary, highlighting its distinction as the oldest theatre in the country. However, the Walnut isn't the only theatre in Pennsylvania that stakes a claim in American theatre history. Since its opening in 1852, the doors of the Fulton Opera House in Lancaster County have remained open, making it the oldest continuously operating theatre building in the nation. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer now reports, the National Historic Landmark Theatre recently named a new artistic director who aims to preserve the theatre's rich heritage while taking the company into new territory.
The Fulton Opera House sits on a busy street in Lancaster City, just around the corner from the town's main square and a few blocks from City Hall. Built in 1852 as a town meeting hall, it has also always been a theater, a place for live theatrical productions, films, and spectacle. Throughout the last century, the building has undergone many changes, most recently a $9.5 million renovation. But walking into the intricately painted auditorium with its towering proscenium arch, old-fashioned box seats on either side of the stage, and a majestic red curtain, the theater evokes the sense of a bygone era. Over the last decade, longtime freelance director Mark Robin has been at the helm of numerous shows at the Fulton Opera House. When the theater's previous artistic director, Michael Mitchell, died of cancer last September, Robin was tapped to step in as interim artistic director before accepting the position on a permanent basis this January. Robin believes his appointment comes at a pivotal time for the company.
Right now, we're sort of poised to go to whatever that next step is for this theater. For the last 9 years being a guest here, I've sort of watched it go from a largely almost community theater type operation to a quote-unquote legitimate, you know, professional house. And now we have the opportunity to sort of become a major regional theater.
The theater is named for Robert Fulton, an American inventor who developed the first commercially successful steamboat. The Pennsylvania native is a continuing part of the theater's legacy, according to Barry Kornhauser, the Fulton Theater's playwright in residence.
Okay, we're coming to the statue of Robert Fulton, the namesake of the theater. It's carved out of one tree trunk, and for over 100 years, the statue stood outside the building. But after a long, long time of cruel winters and crueler pigeons, Robert wasn't doing so well, so they brought him in.
Kornhauser, who's worked at the Fulton for over 25 years and seems to know every chapter of the building's history, explains Fulton Hall, as it was originally known, was constructed on a plot of land where a colonial-era prison once stood, a site known for the 1763 massacre of Conestoga Indians at the hands of vigilantes. When Fulton Hall was designed in the mid-1800s by Philadelphia architect Samuel Sloan, a wall of the prison was left intact to form part of the building's foundation. Tobacco, raw wool, and even manure were stored in the basement of the structure, while the top floor was used as a shooting gallery. From the beginning, the main hall was used as a venue for plays, concerts, lectures, and other forms of entertainment. In the early 1870s, the owner of the hall decided to renovate the building into a more conventional theater space. The auditorium was lowered, balconies were added, and a proscenium arch was installed above the stage.
And this was called an opera house in those days because theater still had that kind of iffy reputation, but opera house sounded a little bit more impressive.
But it wasn't strictly opera.
It was never really opera at all. That was kind of the tradition at the time. People were railing against theater, so they thought, theater owners, that if they called the places opera houses, they could fool some of the people some of the time.
Kornhauser says many famous 19th and 20th century performers passed through the Fulton, including Mark Twain, Buffalo Bill Cody and Wild Bill Hickok, Edwin Booth, Ethel Barrymore, and John Philip Sousa. The space went on to become a vaudeville venue, a movie house, and then a more traditional theater stage again, nearly closing its doors at different junctures, but always somehow surviving. While mindful of its history, managing director Aaron Young says today the company is committed to a contemporary mission.
We're not a museum. We honor what has been done in the past, but it's all about how do we move forward? How do we communicate with an audience now? How do we remain relevant in an era that, you know, has a lot of different options for people's leisure time? We no longer have a monopoly like, you know, we did back in the 1800s when the theater was built.
Remaining relevant to today's audiences, says Mark Robin, means paying close attention to the surrounding community.
You know, make sure that we're not moving so far towards, you know, the next rung of the ladder that we forget where we are to begin with. And that's going to be a really fun juggling act.
The Fulton Opera House is a larger-than-average theater. The horseshoe-shaped Italianate-style auditorium holds about 700 people. Aaron Young says keeping a facility of this size alive means being sensitive to popular demand.
We're more populist than a typical regional theater, because we are so large, we can't be a niche market. And so we tend to do things that will attract attention, but we'll do plays like Old Wicked Songs or Doubt or Pride's Crossing, things that are significant pieces of writing, particularly American drama, that need to be seen, even though we know that they're not going to attract the audiences that Fiddler on the Roof will attract.
The Fulton's new artistic director, Mark Robin, agrees that producing shows with a mass appeal is integral to the Fulton's success.
But I also don't want our entire goal to be about just putting on, you know, shows because they're going to sell. You know, I'd love to be developing new work here, as well as re-envisioning old work.
Though ambitious about the future, Robin says the state of today's economy forces the Fulton to be cautious.
So all the visions in the world mean nothing if we can't sort of turn this tide and turn this corner. So for the next year, possibly two, we're going to play it safer than we would like to eventually.
With Robin's long-term goal to build the Fulton's reputation as a leading regional theater in central Pennsylvania, the historic landmark will continue to be, as it has for more than 150 years, a place for people to gather, be entertained, and consider new ideas. An old architectural treasure and a new artistic director eager to take it into the 21st century, the Fulton story continues.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The home of the Fulton Theater in Lancaster continues its run as the nation's oldest continuously operating theater, with the opening tomorrow night of the Spitfire Grill. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.